It's all in the mind. I was told by my mother one thing leads to the other, but the rule is it's all in the mind. The clerk at the hotel, Melinda, told a newlywed lad named Trinda, don't mind you and the wife, living on fruits of the life, but don't throw the skins out the window. It's all in the mind, it's all in the mind, the rudeness, it's all in the mind. I was told by my mother one thing leads to the other, but the rudeness, it's all in the mind. I saw my best friend named Clyde with a gleaming new bike by his side. It's brilliant, red, and stands by his bed. Well, at least he's assured of a ride. Oh, it's all in the mind, it's all in the mind, with rudeness, it's all in the mind. I was told by my mother one thing leads to the other, but with rudeness, it's all in the mind. Now the dashing young lad's out in Easton for some inexplicable reason. Go out in herds and shoot all the birds, but never when they're out of season. It's all in the mind, it's all in the mind, with rudeness, it's all in the mind. I was told by my mother one thing leads to the other, but with rudeness, it's all in the mind. Hey, it's all in the mind, it's all in the mind. True, with rudeness, it's all in the mind. I tell you, I was told by my mother one thing leads to the other, but with rudeness, it's all in the mind. One more time. It's all in the mind, it's all in the mind, with rudeness, it's all in the mind. I was told by my mother one thing leads to the other, but with rudeness, it's all in the mind.
Rudeness is all in the mind. Yes, that's Judge Dredd. I think within the matter of a couple of weeks, we will probably have played the entire album. We've got a lot of time for him in this show. On my right hand, I have what appears to be... you look like a sort of Victorian gentleman who's been engaging some kind of rapscallionist behaviour in his quarters and has just been thrown out by his landlady.
That's pretty much the image I'm presenting here. Slightly, undone silk cravat and a waistcoat and that kind of thing. My image is constructed entirely around the moustache that I grew a couple of weeks ago.
So. I was going to say, it's kind of looking a bit Vivian Stanshaw-y. I approve.
I've no idea who Vivian Stanshaw is, but I'm gonna find out.
Oh, I'm glad to always spread the word. Oh, great. If somebody was to ask you, who are you? What are you about? What kind of...
I'd say, hi, my name's Ed, and what I'm about is, well, one of the things I'm about is putting on cabarets and art events and, well, helping out with a group, should I say, who put on these kind of things in squatted spaces around Bristol, basically.
Okay. Now, you may know Edward Rapley or his cohorts from an event that happened recently at the Bristol Arts Trade Centre, which was formerly the Dovercourt Audi Garage in Cheltenham Road. So that was called The Road to Nowhere. What was that, in case people don't know?
The Road to Nowhere was, amongst other things, an absolute maddening nightmare in this enormous, it's 115,000 square feet building, basically, mm-hmm. the former Audi Garage. That we put on this, we ran cabarets there, and then the big plan was always to do an enormous sort of site-specific show, like a show that took in, the building was part of the inspiration, so we kind of had four levels at the back, with all really large car park spaces, and there was a basement which I helped to direct along with another guy called Doug. And that was kind of a seedy underworld level of weird, nothing really making sense, no story, no narrative. And then people went up the spiral kind of ramp to the next level, and that was an office scene. And there was this amazing moment where everyone threw paper all over each other, these great big mounds, all the paper that the company had left all their records in the building. So we ended up playing around with them. And then they went through a kind of street scene and then up into the Bang Bang Club, which was basically just this girl called Sarah. Had essentially made a nightclub on one of the floors of the building. It was just absolutely amazing. And then on one of the nights, we went upstairs and there was the roof and there was a kind of fire show. And the other night, we just kind of worked our way down into the building, and then there was a cabaret show after each night, basically.
It sounds really full on. So how many of you are there doing this?
Well, it's kind of fluctuated. I suppose to give you the full kind of history of it, we were originally at a place just over the road from the Dover Court Garage, 157. And we sort of ran a couple of, ran an enormous party there, which was an absolute nightmare. Hundreds and hundreds of people turning up. We had this a large kind of warehouse space at the back of this house. And we put on a big party there, and that was a nightmare. So we decided to do things a little bit more controlled. We ran a few cabarets and then did these performances in the basement of the house. And kind of inspired by the success of those, and then having to move out of that place, we'd had an agreement with the landlord, who was really good with us, and we moved out of there and literally spent a day carting our stuff over to the place over the road, which we just put the locks on, basically.
All right. I mean, some people are going to ask, wow, this is all kind of daring. Is it legal?
Yeah. Pretty much. I hope so. No, but certainly the whole squatting side of it is, it's not illegal to squat a building as long as you don't cause any criminal damage to the property whilst you're getting in. And in the case of all the squats we've done, they've always been doors that have been open, windows that have been open. We've not damaged anything going in. We've just taken out the locks and put our own ones in. And then we've kind of got possession of the building, and that means that they then have to apply to the courts to get an eviction notice.
Okay.
And that's kind of the premise of us being able to do what we do with, the premise of the entire nature of squatting in the UK kind of thing.
I mean, some people would say there's an advantage because you're keeping the building in sort of good working order.
This is one of the major arguments in my mind for kind of responsible and creative squatting is that I know for sure we, hundreds and hundreds of man hours went into maintaining and making safe the space of the Dover Court Audi, which was an absolute death trap. Just to give you a bit of an idea of what the building was like inside. It just been kind of torn apart. Kids got in there and junkies as well. The final point we decided to take it was when we started finding needles in the doorway, and we're just like, right, well, if we leave it any longer, this place is, going to become absolutely useless. And there's live wires hanging out of the ceiling, and there was people had been in scrapping it, so they were taking apart the building, ripping out the copper pipes whilst the water was still on. So there was a hot one side of the house. If you look at the building, it's the big white building on by a set of traffic lights on Cheltenham Road.
Okay.
And you can see like a yellow brick building to the side, and that entire house has been completely ruined by water damage. They let the water run for about a month or so, just pouring through the ceiling onto a pile of papers, literally a room that was waist high in paper, and this later became the mould room, and developed its own unique and deadly ecosystem of mould and animals and weirdness, and we tried to clear it, and I think we got about halfway through before we got evicted.
Did that provide you with any artistic inspiration?
I'm sure it will do once I've digested the horror that it actually was. It was quite tragic. I think we just sealed the doors and ignored it. But yeah, it was pretty it's pretty intense. And so we kind of spent a lot of time clearing up the building, shift several tons of paperwork, and making good the electrics. We had a lot of help from a guy called Eamon, essentially a saint. Captain Weldo was his name, and he helped weld shut all the windows at the back that kids were breaking through, and really helped us out a lot. Did all the wiring for the place and got electricity to the places that there wasn't electricity, basically.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So behind the theatrical facade, I mean, what is the cause? What is the reason behind it all? Why do you do it?
Good grief, that's a question, isn't it? I suppose we just love performing. I love performing. That's what I do. I'm a performer, and the other people have got kind of ideas when I realise though that was the kind of one of the main guys behind it, call him Dr. Francisco. For the purposes of this interview, he's one of the head honchos behind the kind of Invisible Circus and their whole thing. And he's been a performer for at least the last 10 years or so, And it's just about putting on things that people enjoy and things that people want to come and watch and that we want to do, And essentially, squatting these kind of spaces gives us the freedom to put on these kind of events and the possibility to do, these kind of things.
All right, well, I think we'll pause there, and we'll just kind of break it up with some piece of music, and we'll come back to Edward Rapley in a moment.
Hear a rumble and I turn. really not funny. Check to see if I have money. Grabbing some sauce that is runny. Don't think I can carry on further. I'm needing a Coke and a burger. For fries I've become a goat herder. Hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, I lie. Clothes are no longer to fit me, cause I'm becoming a fatty. I tell my white waistline Birkins, I'm looking like Christopher Biggins. Need to get me some exercise, start dreaming lots about large fries. Get in the gym and start running, to burn some more calories. I predict a diet. And if you really can't see your feet, then you gotta stop munching on me. Carry on further. I'm needing a Coke and a burger. From fries I become a goat herder. A diggity gurdy. La 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 la. I predict a diet. I like burgers and I like fries, but they have to be supersized. I predict a diet.
He predicts a diet. That was Chris Miles, the so-called saviour of another radio station other than ours. Probably not quite as good as ours, is it, really? We're clearly the best. All right, we're back with Edward Rapley. We're going to chat a little bit more about, I think perhaps about the wider squatting community. A lot of people sort of have stereotypes in their mind as, you know, squatters, as sort of the underclass of society, possibly drug abusers. Why do they do it? What is the wider squatting community like? Where do you fit into it?
Kind of, essentially, I'm one of these folks, my entire lifestyle does, I've thought about it briefly this evening, does kind of involve entirely around squats. I work and perform in squatted spaces, and I also live in a squat, and it allows me and a lot of other people in similar kind of positions to be able to do what we want to do, because we'd have to pay rent, essentially. If I had to pay rent, I wouldn't be able to do what I want to do to such an extent, because I'd have to get a job to pay for it, basically. The amount of money I earn from performing is pretty much nothing. I think if I was going to work out my average annual income from performing, I think it would probably be less than about £3,000, and that isn't even enough to pay rent, let alone live on. So... I think there's a lot to be said, like I mentioned before, about responsible squatting. You know, there's lots of squats in Bristol. There's quite a large amount of people who do squat, and most of them are really, really responsible. And, you know, you'd go past the houses and you wouldn't realise, you know, that was a place that was being squatted. I mean, they kind of, you know, there's nothing particularly special about them except that they're not legally allowed. well, they are legally out, but they don't have a tenancy agreement. That's what it is. It's about security of tenure. You know, they could be kicked out within, you know, 24 hours of the owners of the place getting a court eviction. You know, and that's really the only difference, I suppose.
I mean, how do you kind of like the risk that you might be get chucked out at any moment?
Oh, or is that... No. The risk is a nightmare. You know, the risk is the price you pay, and that insecurity really is that, you know, you pay your rent so that you've got the security, and it's probably worth it if you can afford it. You know, because I've had situations where I was out at a festival along with a friend who lived in the same house, and the other two people who lived in this house, which we were squatting, were just at work, and the landlord came round, which he is legally entitled to do if there's nobody in the premises, and he kicked the door down and put all our stuff on the street, and I kind of, you know, get a phone call at the festival saying, Ed, bad news, all your stuff's on the street, and I'm just kind of stuck going, well, I'm homeless now, so what do I do? Luckily, loads of people helped us out, and everything was fine, but, you know, it's not. I enjoy the possibilities, but I don't. You know, there's a price to pay, and that's insecurity.
Right. Is there anything you miss about the regular lifestyle, as you might term it?
My lifestyle hasn't changed massively since I've. It has changed massively, but there isn't a lot I miss, as it were, because the only difference is not having to work to pay rent. Which is a positive thing in a way.
So what's advantageous about doing these kind of theatrical performances and art spaces in this kind of sort of clandestine way, if you like, rather than to kind of traditional venues like the Arnolfini? Or...
Yeah, full respect to the Arnolfini and what they do, but you know, they have their own organisational goals, and they're going a different way to what we want to do. We couldn't just bowl up and say, oh, we've got this great idea for a show, let's put it on, because we're unheard of. You know, people don't know what we do, and they necessarily want us to perform there. I mean, I'd say, Arnolfini, if you're listening, it'd be great. I'd love a commission. You know, to have the freedom, the creative freedom to be able to do what we want to do, these are the spaces that we need. Ideally, what we'd like to have is our own space on a more permanent, stable basis. We're looking at the moment for landlords to perhaps have buildings that are being left empty or awaiting development. And we're looking for, you know, the potential to become licensees of these premises and help caretake them, but at the same time use them for putting on shows. And in my mind, the thing I'm after personally is a theatre space, a small theatre space which supports emerging artists working across a range of disciplines in Bristol. You know.
Okay, and that's part of your project, Art Space, Life Space.
Certainly, is that it's essentially this is. A kind of collective project. It was the name behind the what happened at the Bristol Arts Trade Centre, the Dover Court Garage, and if you're interested in these kind of things, then check out Art Space Life Space on the web. Just artspace/lifespace, and sign yourself up to the mailing list, and you'll get to find out about all these odd, bizarre things that you wouldn't necessarily realise were happening on your high street.
All right. Is that .co.uk, is it?
I believe it's .co.uk, but as always, you know, Google is there to...
Clear these things up.
Clear these things up, yeah.
Okay, so they can have a look at the website, and any email addresses and stuff will...
There should be a little link to the mailing list, and sign up, and you'll get all the info.
All right. I mean, what kind of acts would you get in one of these sort of invisible circus stroke kind of clandestine cabaret acts?
Just about kind of more traditional acts, as talk about them, you know, jugglers and acrobats and aerialists. The current space, we've got a couple of rigging points for aerials, so people doing rope and silks and that kind of thing. Musical acts, and then there's kind of the oddball stuff that I do, curing mannequins of sort of existential apathy and getting people to chant that they love life, and then, you know, getting naked on stage, these kind of antics. So you can pretty much expect you know, something fun, something weird, and something great.
Excellent. Okay. What are you planning sort of in the near or medium future? What can people expect to hear from the Invisible Circus or Art Space Life Space?
From the Invisible Circus, I suppose next year's check out they'll be making lots of kind of festival appearances. The Invisible Circus does kind of festival stages. And also from Art Space, Light Space, hopefully a more permanent venue. That's what we're looking for at the moment. But in the meantime, I can't say too much about we currently have a venue in Bristol that we're doing cabarets in on a generally kind of bi-weekly basis, you know, once every couple of weeks basis. We don't know how much longer we've got it. We've got an eviction order against us, but no bailiffs yet. So we're just kind of hanging in there. And to find out about that, sign up to the mailing list.
So it's going to be a pretty tense Christmas.
It could be a tense Christmas, but
or a homeless Christmas.
Well, luckily it's not. Nobody's relying on this performance space for living space as well at the moment. Okay. So that's a good thing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in, Mr. Rapley.
It's been a pleasure.
And I look forward to hearing from you and going to see some of these things around Bristol.
Wonderful.
Best of luck to you.
Take care.
All right. That was the Pogues. Nice to hear that. Okay, well, we go straight on to our next guest tonight. We have Ursula here in the studio to tell us about some modern-day fairy stories. How are you doing? You all right?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Very nice of you to come. Very nice of you to take time out. So you're part of a kind of a quarterly live short stories kind of event.
I run an event called Heads and Tails. It's a quarterly live short story event, and the last one we had was at Halloween. It was in a crypt in central Bristol, so we had a Halloween special in a crypt, which went down very, very well. We've got sort of some regular storytellers, which are all kind of up-and-coming writers in Bristol. Sort of one or two people that do it have actually sort of at the stage of having novels published and contracts and that kind of stuff. Other people are sort of at a stage of, you know, just starting out a bit more with the writing, but it's a really, really good night, and we're hoping to have a website up and running by early January. So that's going to be www.headsandtails, and that's tails as in fairy tales, not tales of an animal.
Yeah.
So it's headsandtails.org.uk. So from January, you should be able to go onto that, and you'll be able to read some of my stories and some of the other contributors' stories, and just generally have a look a bit more at what we do.
All right.
The next Heads and Tails event, I think, is going to be early February, and it's probably going to be it'll be a bit ahead of Valentine's Day, but it's going to be a night of warped love stories, I think. So.
Oh, excellent. All right. I mean, how long have you been writing these stories?
I started off working on a novel a couple of years ago, and the short stories were sort of slightly a distraction from doing the novel, but they've become more and more distracting, so they're now taking up about half of my writing time. It's a very good way of getting rid of ideas, because I know some writers struggle for ideas, and I just struggle to find time to write down my ideas. So it's a very good way of dispatching an idea in a short amount of time. So I've got a short story on Radio 4 in January, which is great. But it's quite hard to find places to place short stories these days because they're very out of fashion with publishers. But what we've actually been finding is that if you actually offer to tell somebody a story in the old-fashioned sense, people absolutely love it. They really, really like the immediacy. They really like... just the originality of hearing a new story it's not like traditional storytelling, that we don't sort of so much retell versions of old stories. It's all brand new writing, and it's all pretty much either from Bristol or around. I think last event somebody came down from Yorkshire especially, which was quite nice. But I think, you know, what we found at the events is people aren't quite sure before they've come the first time, and then when they've been, they've really got the concept of what we're trying to do, and they just love that experience of being told stories, you know, sort of live and direct.
So. Kind of takes you back to sort of being a child, I imagine.
Very much so, yeah. And what we try and sort of recreate is that atmosphere of, in a way, sitting around a campfire and being told a story. Though obviously we haven't done an event with a real campfire yet, but next summer we'd like to. That would be great.
So what kind of genres of story at these short story events would you sort of expect to hear? A mix or...?
A mix. I mean, we look at anything, but I think because of telling it live, it does kind of tend towards sort of slightly darker, maybe a bit more humorous, a bit more fantastical. Kind of those sort of traditional sort of fairy tale elements do tend to come out quite strong. And I think there's also quite a strong kind of West Country sense of warpedness going on in there, which I think is quite a regional thing, because I have actually been to a slightly similar event in London, and the kind of stories were entirely different. They're very, very urban and contemporary. Whereas I think we go for a slightly more... There's a bit more of the countryside creeping into us. But yes, I think quite dark, quite humorous. I think the humour is quite a strong point. Right.
Okay. So have this novel that you kind of are getting distracted away from, is it sort of now almost totally on the back burner as it was to...
It's creeping along, but at a slightly slower pace. But that's also a version of an old fairy story. It's a much longer version than you would get in a short story. And what I tend to do, I mean, I very much like old stories and myths, but... they need to be reinvented in a modern way, so that's what I try and do. And sometimes I use an old story, and sometimes I just maybe take elements that you would get in an old story and use that in a contemporary way.
Okay.
But I very much like the element of sort of fantasticalness that you get in old stories.
I mean, I remember when I first saw you, and that was at the New Found Out in Totterdown.
Yes, part of the Arts Trail.
Particularly rowdy gigs. Bucky had just played, I think. So what kind of a variety of gigs do you do? What's the craziest gigs you kind of do, reading or standing there reading a short story?
I don't know. I've done one on a boat. Probably, I have to say, doing one in the Crypt was certainly the oddest venue. We were slightly worried that everyone would be sort of creeped out by being in the Crypt. But actually, by the time we'd stuffed 70 people and a load of candles in there, it was actually quite a warm and pleasant environment to be in. But very, very strange acoustics. And I also did a gig on the boat... the Word Boat project that was running in the summer, and actually that was, although the audience were very, very polite, that was actually really, really difficult acoustics. So I don't like to use a microphone when I'm telling a story live, because you get a much, much better quality just off the person's voice.
Yeah.
So there's some kind of venues that I really wouldn't do, because you need a microphone, and you need, I think with the story, what you do is you need to pull people in,
yeah,
and you need to kind of wrap the story around them. And if you're not in an environment where you can do that, I just tend not to do it.
Okay.
Because you have to kind of draw people into the narrative. It's not particularly like a sort of stand-up thing that goes down terribly well in the pub. And I think that gig you saw me at, I think that's the first, probably the rowdiest one that I've done.
Yeah.
But very complimentary to share a bill with Bucky, so that was good.
They are a tremendous local act, and they've got a new album out as well. All the new mistakes. That's true. Yes, yeah. So you can look them up on the internet. But for us, you're going to make an exception and speak into our microphone
indeed.
To our awaiting listeners.
Right. This is a story called The Box, and I wrote it after spending a few days hanging around on the beach at Goran Haven in Cornwall last year.
Okay.
So really, I just thought I should... I had the idea while I was loitering on the beach, and I thought if I write it, I would have not entirely wasted all the time.
All right, well, sit back, lie back, listeners. Not if you're driving, obviously. Keep your eyes on the road. But relax. And this is The Box by Ursula.
It was Emily, the youngest, who found the box. "Dad," she said, returning from a foray into the other part of the beach, the part that got cut off when the tide came in. "There's a big box on the beach. It's, like, black and big and... a box." I bet it smells of fish, said Jemima with 13-year-old superiority. Maybe it's a coffin, said Jack, so his sister began to whimper. Jack, said his father. He took his whimpering youngest by the hand and marched off round the rocks, ready to dispel any demons he found there. I'll come, yelled Jack, and ran after them. Jemima trailed behind, feigning disinterest. Duh, she said, tossing blonde hair. It's bound to be crap. But when they rounded the corner of the rock, they could see the box, sticking up at an angle out of the sand, its wet black top shining darkly in the sun. It was made of metal, though whether it was painted or just old was hard to tell. Here, Dad, said Jack, jumping forward. Let's open it. Wait, shouted Graham. It might be dangerous. The box looked like it might have been in the water for some time, and thoughts of unexploded ordnance or of drug caches dumped overboard began to fill his mind. Emily, he said to his youngest, you did very well to tell me about this. Now, what do you think is the right thing to do? Emily looked up at her father, unable to discern the answer. Open it carefully with a stick, offered Jack. No, Jack, said his father, sighing. No, said Jemima. The correct thing to do, everybody, is to report it to the authorities. And with this, Graham fished his mobile phone out of the pocket of his beach shorts. He couldn't help noticing a tinge of disappointment on all his children's faces, but they had to learn. Graham led the children back to where Saskia, his wife, was still reading her stupid novel. His wife was useless on holiday. She didn't want to play beach ball or have quality time at all. She just wanted to lie on the sand. Back in a moment, Saskia, he said, but she just murmured and turned over the page. He climbed the stairs to the promenade and stood in a doorway. Then he dialed 999. After several attempts, he was put through to the local police station. When he'd finished explaining, there was a brief silence. I'll just put you on hold, said the man on the line. There was a faint clumping and knocking noise, and then the same voice said quite clearly, You'll never guess what, Colin, is that friggin' box again? You're bloody joking, said a voice in the background. Turned up again, has it? Where's it bloody now, then? A few more shreds of information were passed across in a muffled sort of way. Tell him it's been investigated. It's been investigated, sir. Graham could feel his face flushing. In London, indeed, in any half-decent city, they could be sacked for that sort of attitude. I thought, better safe than sorry. Children on the beach, you know. Absolutely, sir. Absolutely, said the man on the phone, followed by a sound like the unwrapping of tin foil. Graham pressed the red button. Saskia sat up on the sand and put down her book. She never got a chance to read in peace. What was in the box, she asked. Dad wouldn't let us open it, said Jack. Yes, but what is it? The three of them shrugged in unison, like a choir of shruggers. She said, if you want something doing, do it yourself. She got up, dusting sand off her bottom. There's nothing to see, said Jemima, throwing herself down on the towel. As Saskia approached the box, she noticed her family's footsteps were already obliterated, as if no one had been there. The sand must be very damp for the tracks to fade so quickly. She looked for signs or markings to suggest that the box might belong to a boat. Finding none, she leant down, lifted up the catch, and raised the lid. Inside was a thing of such horror that she turned aside and retched. Jemima waited, fidgeting, till her mother returned. Mum, she said, do you think that Dad's, like, a bit paranoid sometimes? Paranoid, said her mother, but she seemed a bit dazed, so Jemima dropped it. Can I have the car keys, she said. I want to get my cardigan. Saskia handed over the keys. Jemima stuffed them into her little bag, the one she had bought in the tourist shop 2 days ago. She went up the lane, past her father on the phone, onto the coast path, and turned right down the steep steps to the beach where the box still lay. She raised the clip, a little gingerly, and looked inside. The box was full of photographs. The thing was full, right to the lid. They were all kinds of photographs, battered and crinkled, shiny and new, weddings and holiday snaps, school photographs, ranks of aeroplanes lined up on tarmac, models in long dresses. She sifted them at random, and the people and cats and dogs and chalets ran through her fingers. Reluctantly, she looked around and put the lid down, though really she wanted to pick up the photos and examine them, one by one, the dresses, the big ships, the cats with pink bows round their necks. She wondered what would happen when the police came to take away the box. She hoped they would find who owned the pictures and not burn them or anything. When she got back, no one noticed that she didn't have her cardigan. That was easily the most interesting thing that had happened all holiday. If her dad hadn't been so paranoid, she would have talked about it, but her dad would probably have accused her of disturbing a crime scene or something, and she didn't fancy getting a bollocking on the last day of the holidays. Jack swam out into the water. He put his feet down, feeling the push and pull of the waves. Gradually, slowly, he swam a bit to the left, then a bit further, then a bit further again. Sometimes his family were a bit stupid. When he was out of sight, he climbed back onto the beach and walked up to the box. He raised the lid. Inside was a large walrus wearing a pair of wire-rimmed spectacles. "Can I help you?" said the walrus. Said Jack. "No, sorry, not really. I just wondered what was inside the box." The walrus raised a flipper and tapped the side of its nose. "Secret mission," it said. "Very important. You don't tell anyone you saw me." "Sandwich?" it added, offering Jack what appeared to be a sardine butty. "No, thanks," said Jack. "Better close the lid," said the walrus, "before anyone notices." Jack replaced the lid carefully and walked off down the beach. That night, as the barbecue cooled, Graham did something despicable. He waited till his wife was in the shower, opened the toolbox in the back of the car, and checked the contents. "You know," he said when his wife returned, "I think I left my fleece on the beach." "You'll never see that again," she said. "Honestly, Saskia, you're such a defeatist," he said. Graham drove off, forcing a smaller car to retreat up the single-lane road. Over dinner, he'd become convinced that the box contained something really important. It was obviously full of cocaine, kilos and kilos of stuff, and when the proper police managed to override those clueless provincial oiks, he would be credited with the biggest drug seizure made all year. It would lead to the conviction of a big mafia don, a real important guy that the cops had been after for years, and his persistence, his find of the box, would be the key. Graham could already see himself in a witness protection program, trailed by a security minder, and having to change his name and his job and maybe get a hair transplant and some cosmetic surgery so the mafia couldn't find him. The tide had come further in, but the box was still visible. He balanced the torch on a rock, took a screwdriver from the toolkit, leant forward, inserted it under the clasp, and heaved. The clasp remained stubbornly stuck. Sighing, he crouched a little closer. He knew he was being irrational. It was possible that the thing would blow up in his face, but he felt he was being left no choice. No choice at all. Nothing moved. The thing was obviously more corroded than it looked. He put down the screwdriver and gave it one quick, sharp blow with the axe. A dull, ringing sound came from inside. That sound infuriated him. It was like the bloody thing was laughing at him. He dropped the axe onto his foot and stuck his fingers under the lid, groaning and swearing. The box moved slightly in the sand. He went back to the car, found a can of oil in the car jack. He oiled the clasp, took a larger screwdriver, tried the jack. He took the axe again and hit the box from different angles. He became aware that he was grunting and that, if discovered, would find it hard to explain his actions. A frenzy of frustration came over him. Tears spilled from his eyes. This was his whole life laid out, a life in which all his efforts, all his intentions were mocked, in which he was nobody, and all his PowerPoint presentations on useful ways to improve the distribution structure of the regional offices were thrown unceremoniously in the director's personal waste bin. He kicked the box, then jumped around, clutching his toes. He seized the axe and in a frenzy began beating it. A kind of hollow, clonking noise came from inside. He raised his voice and yelled. In the quietness that followed, he became aware that his foot was bleeding. The fog of humiliation filled his whole body. Defeated, he limped back up the path. Next day, they were already 30 miles up the road, when Jemima said, "Here, Mum, did you give Emily those pearls?" "What pearls?" said Saskia, juggling the road atlas on her lap. "Those pearls, the ones she's wearing?" "Have you got some pearls, dear?" asked Saskia, turning round. "No," said Emily, in defiance of the obvious evidence. Saskia could see them wound tight round her little neck. "Did you give them to her?" Saskia asked her husband. "What pearls?" he said, and began to overtake a caravan. "Ugh," said Jack, "she stole them." "Jack," said his father. "She must have got them with her pocket money," said Jemima. "They look like very good fakes," said Saskia, doubtfully, though what she actually thought was, "Christ, they look real." "Where did they come from, dear?" Silence descended on the car. Everyone, apart from Graham, who was driving, stared at Emily. "Emily," he said, "answer your mother's question." "Yeah, you liar," said Jack. Emily began to cry. "Right, that's it," shouted Graham, and seeing a petrol station, he began to pull over. "Everybody out, not you, Emily." Saskia, Jack and Jemima went into the services. "Mum, you look a bit ill," said Jemima, but her mother was already sprinting for the toilets. She followed her in, but there was only a locked cubicle and the sound of retching. Jemima retreated and leant against the sinks. Emily had obviously got the necklace from underneath the photographs. It must have been down there. Maybe there was other jewellery and she hadn't dug down, hadn't looked, hadn't had the guts. How stupid! She kicked the base of the sink, furious with herself. Jack looked at the crisps in the shop. It seemed unfair. Emily'd got a bloody necklace, and all the walrus had offered to him was a lousy fish sandwich. He peeked through the window. In the forecourt, he could see his father shouting at Emily, who was crying in the back seat of the 4x4. After a while, his father stormed into the shop. "I can't get a thing out of her," he fumed. "I think you might be right, Jack. She may have stolen them. The humiliation, at least the other members of this family know right from wrong, and..." Something in his son's face made him know that Jack, too, had opened the box. "How'd you get in?" he yelled. "How'd you get in?" Jack recoiled, his face twitching. "I don't know what you're on about, Dad." Graham stormed out into the foyer, but at that moment his wife and daughter appeared, looking terrible. Dad, I think she's, like, not well," said Jemima. She looked a bit frightened. Saskia's face was white, and her eyes red from crying. "I want a divorce," she said. "I've done something terrible." Graham stared at his wife like she had just declared herself to be a Martian. "You've all gone mad," he said. "Mad! Get in the car!" And then he saw his reflection in the glass of the foyer, a middle-aged man, red-faced, puffy, balding and swearing, with his hands clenched into fists, and the desire, the urge to smash something, overwhelmed him so fast he let out a moan. When they got back to the car, there was no one there. Emily was gone. The doors were locked, and the keys were in Graham's pocket, but Emily was just gone. They searched in the toilets and in the restaurant, and half an hour passed. They called the police. Another hour passed, and more policemen arrived, and they searched everywhere, and she was still nowhere. Nowhere at all. Two policemen came and took Jack aside in the cafe and got out notebooks and wrote down everything he said about how their dad had been grumpy and their mum had been ill and everything, and at last he said, "I think it might have been something to do with the box, actually." The policeman stopped writing. He pushed his glasses up his nose, peered at Jack and looked at his colleague. "Colin," he said, "I can't believe it." The other policeman shook his head sadly. "Sorry, son," he said. "We can't get rid of it. Happens every year, somewhere. We can't even find it. Soon as we go and look for it, it's gone." And with this, they sighed, flipped their notepads shut, and drained the last of their coffee.
Thank you very much, Laura. I really enjoyed listening to that. That was fantastic. Thank you very much. So, look out for the future. What was that website once again?
That'd be Heads and Tails. www.headsandtails.org.uk, right. And I think the next event's going to be in early February.
Early February, all right, so look out for that. That's not quite up at the moment. We're going to move on straight now to the What's On Guide with the wonderful Jeff Sparks, and time for him to tell us what's going on. So we're going to do a quick swap change. It's one in, one out, like the Grand Prix. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm fine, thanks.
All right. Okay, well, what's going on?
Okay, starting with tomorrow night, and at Fiddler's in Wailway Street, Bristol, there is a night of local folk talent featuring Jim Moray, Jane Taylor and Babel. Tickets are £7 in advance, and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and the honours go to a musician named Guy Blakesley, who performs under the name Entrance. Now this track is from his latest album, Prayer of Death, and is titled Grim Reaper Blues. We'll be right back. was Guy Blakesley with the track Grim Reaper Blues. For more information on this musician, you can check him out at either www.entranceband.com or myspace.com/entrancerecords. Moving on to Saturday night, and at Mr. Wolf's, which is at 33 St. Stephen Street, Bristol, the ever-popular group John E. Vistick Experience will be performing. The gig should start around 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Also on Saturday night, and this time at the Bunch of Grapes in Denmark Street, Bristol, the up-and-coming and, in my opinion, quite talented local rock and roll originals and covers group The Woods will be performing. Entry is free and the gig should start around 8:30 p.m. Finally, on Saturday night, at the Cheese and Grain in Frome, it's another date on the Mad, Bad and Dangerous tour, featuring the Hamsters, Wilco Johnson and John Otway. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £16.50 in advance, and £17 on the door. Finally, on Sunday at the Star and Garter in Montpellier in Bristol, Vladimir Steamboat will be performing. The gig should start around 9 p.m, with entry being £3 on the door. That is all from me tonight. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. Take care and good night.
Radio on.
Radio on.
Radio on. Radio on.
Radio on.
Radio, radio on. On.
All right, thank you very much, Jeff, for the weekly What's On guides. Now, it's nearly the end of another Radio Dalek show, and time is running out. But before we go, we've got time for some poetry. So this is Carmen Alfonso, who's going to read a poem from her latest poetry book.
Miss Carmen Alfonso and I will be reading two poems of my book of poetry, On the Island of My Bed, Living with Lyme Disease. The book can be bought at Arnolfini Bookshop, and I have published it to raise awareness of Lyme disease, which I have had for the last 10 years. So the first poem is called On the Island of My Bed, and it's dedicated to a little girl called Molly who used to come to see me. On the Island of My Bed. When I lived on the island of my bed, when north held my sore head, and south my hopeless feet, she used to come through the door, holding tight her worn out little yellow duck. She came with a song or a story to tell, with something in her pocket, or she came silent with sleep. She would lay it out all there for me, music, treasures, tales and dreams, and for the first time in the day, I could fly away from the island of my bed. And the second poem I'm going to read is called Tree Woman. Tree Woman.
All right, we're going to stop there because we're really out of time. I'm very sorry. Next week, we'll be featuring The Quiz. Who is that woman? The final part of the Brunel tour, and we've got the 7-Eleven interview with William Rodriguez. 9-11, sorry, which I'm really looking forward to, and all the other items that we basically just haven't had time for. Too much wonderfulness. Next week we'll have another magazine program packed with interviews, features, music, as well as our regular slots. The Recipe, yes, and the quiz live from the Trinity Centre in Bristol. Chris Merritt will be here live in the studio talking about his vintage motorcycle collection and his Green Goddess. No, not the Kipfeet Fanatic, but the auxiliary fire engine. Carmen Alfonso will be telling us about Lyme's disease and how her poems are helping sufferers. News and weather forecast was courtesy of Metz.check.com. News and weather were read by Richard Ayres. The studio managers were Richard Ayres and Gavin Thomas. The What's On by Jeff Sparks. The show was produced by Anthony Page, and it's just time to remind you that this is a voluntary organisation. If you want to get in touch and find out more about us, check out radiodialect.net. So it's goodbye from me, John, Peters Coleman. Tune in next week at the same time. Stay tuned, of course, we've got the Kid Carpet Megastore coming up, but that's all from Radio Dialect for tonight. Take care.
Radio Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check our website on radiodialect.net.
Radiodialect.net. Radiodialect.net.
Radio Dialect. Transmit. Radio Dialect. Transmit. Radio Dialect. Transmit. Radio Dialect. Transmit.
Radio Dialect. Transmit.